It's the 9th of December 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a radio programme and podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: is the newly discovered Earth 2.0 like Pandora from Avatar? By which I mean, is it overhyped and not quite as good as it seems? If the government deliberately shares NHS data with others, will this be better than the previous method, which was to just leave laptops on trains? Is using computer-generated models to show off clothing going to lead to impressionable teenagers not going on a diet, but going on a defrag? And as the Voyager probe prepares to leave our solar system, will Trekkies finally admit that Enterprise is the better series? But before we start this week, some admin. Regular listeners to the Pod Delusion will know that I tend to end each programme with a really awkward begging segment, and it's about to get a whole lot more awkward. As you may have seen on Twitter this week, our deputy editor, Liz Luggendorf, has just lost her job, and I live with Liz, so this leaves us both, and the Pod Delusion, in potential financial peril. So if you've ever thought of donating or supporting the programme, now would be a really good time. If you head over to our website at poddelusion.co.uk, you can make a one-off donation, or find links to subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month to help the cause. If everyone who listened to the show gave us a fiver, not just Liz, but I too would be able to work on the show full-time, which would mean we could cover more events, interview more people, offer more bonus content, and improve the quality of contributions. We'd also upgrade the website. I'd love to build an iPlayer-like service through which people can listen back to individual reports, for instance. But at the moment, we simply don't have the time or the money. So please do head over to poddelusion.co.uk and support Liz and the Pod Delusion. I've also posted her CV on there, so if you do have any leads on jobs, let us know. It's a shame this isn't a religious podcast, really, as then I'd be able to claim that God will grant you a wish if you donate or something like that. But anyway, let's have an awkward segue and get on with the show! We start this week in space with the most important discovery in the history of space exploration since astronomers discovered the moon. Or at least, that's perhaps what the media might want you to think. As you may have seen, this week, the discovery of Earth 2 was announced. As far as I can tell, it's essentially the same as Earth 1, but is set in an airport. Some astronomers, though, seem to be of a differing opinion, as Kash Farouk has been finding out.
This week saw a major exoplanet announcement from the Kepler team. The planet has been given the official name Kepler-22b. It also has a far catchier nickname, Earth 2.0. Initially, I didn't think the story warranted a Pod Delusion report. Exoplanet discovery announcements are becoming fairly regular. But then, I started reading more and more blogs and tweets from unhappy astronomers. With the power of Twitter, thanks Twitter, I found one of those unhappy astronomers to talk to. So, here is an interview with Oxford University's Rob Simpson to discuss why astronomers are getting so annoyed. Hi Rob, first, can you introduce yourself and explain what you do?
Yes, hi, my name is Robert Simpson. I work at Oxford University for the Zooniverse. I'm a web developer and researcher, and principally involved with the Milky Way project at the Zooniverse, but have a hand in lots of other things. We just launched another project of mine called Whale FM.
Okay. All right. Starting with the basics, can you explain to our listeners what Kepler is?
Yes. Well, Kepler actually is related to another one of these Zooniverse projects that I work on, which is Planet Hunters, which uses Kepler data. And Kepler is a spacecraft that is staring at one patch of the sky, which is in Cygnus, and it's staring at about 100,000 stars, and it measures the light coming out of those every half an hour. And what it builds up is a very detailed light curve, so the way the light changes over time. And this is interesting for all sorts of reasons. You can study variable stars in this way, for example. But really, what Kepler's doing is it is looking for the telltale sign of a planet transiting in front of that star. So if the planet and star are just aligned correctly from our perspective, then when the planet passes in front, we'll see a tiny little dip in the light coming out of that star. It's equivalent to like a mosquito flying in front of a headlight, I think is the statistic you're normally given. And so, very, very sensitive, watches these little dips and starts to build up a picture of the various transits around different planets, and is doing that for several years.
Yeah, I've had a go at Planet Hunters. It's strangely addictive.
Yeah, it's funny how you can get people hooked on looking at graphs.
So, the Kepler team made an announcement that has been hyped in the press. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this was the discovery, the announcement of Kepler-22b, which is a planet that is in the they call it the habitable zone. I think my colleague Chris Lintott would prefer me to call it the Goldilocks zone, and I think he's right. The Goldilocks zone is the region around a star where we would expect water to exist in a liquid form. So it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. Hence the Goldilocks. Habitable implies that you could live there, but of course that's not necessarily true. There's all sorts of other factors involved, but that's the idea. And so Kepler-22b is one of the first planets they found in this zone, and it's also 2.4 times the diameter of the Earth, which means that it falls into the category of Earth-like, as is often described in the media and in much conversation. This is where I start to get slightly annoyed with the story, because we don't actually know the mass of this planet. We know its size because what we're observing is a transit, so we can sort of measure the shadow as it passes almost in front of the star. So we know that it's that big, but we don't know how massive it is. We know that it's going around the star on the order of years, and that it's the right distance away from the star to be in this Goldilocks zone. So a lot of people have then said, well, hey, it's Earth's twin, was how it was being proclaimed on the BBC News, for example. But that's not necessarily true. 2.4 times the diameter of the Earth, but not knowing the density of the planet, means it could be quite a lot bigger than the Earth in terms of its mass. It could be much more like Uranus, for example. It could be a gas giant planet. It's just a small one. If you think that 2.4 times bigger than the Earth is Earth-like, well, 0.5 times the size of Uranus is pretty Uranus-like in the same way. So it's a little bit of a leap, which is what's gotten some people in the astronomical community slightly irked.
Okay, so what do you think is wrong with them making these sort of claims? Is it just because they haven't got enough data yet?
Well, it's not so much that. I mean, it is a remarkable discovery. I mean, apparently the first transit, because Kepler likes to watch a planet go across a star at least three times in order to call that a definite planet. So two transits and lets you predict a third one, and if you see that third one, then you're going to call that one a planet. So if you see three, we call it real. It's a bit like needing a five sigma result in lots of parts of science. But in this case, the first transit was actually recorded only days after the Kepler mission began, and the most recent one wasn't that long ago. So we are now starting to be able to look for planets that are going around their stars over a very long period of time. And of course, if you want to find an Earth-like planet, you're going to need to see planets going around their stars roughly once a year. But so it's not that we don't have enough data. It's not that the discovery isn't impressive, because it is. I mean, these things are small and very far away. I mean, this thing is 600 light years away, I think. It's more the kind of aspect of crying wolf, I think, would be the best expression. I worry, as many people do, that if we keep announcing that we've discovered the twin of Earth, then when we do finally discover the twin of Earth, as in a one Earth mass planet orbiting at one AU around a sun-like star, then it's going to be possibly, really? Oh, you found lots of those, says Joe Bloggs in the Public. And that would be an awful shame if that happens. So it's brilliant. And actually, I was corrected today. We were recording the Recycled Electrons podcast I did with Chris Lintott, and I was ranting about this at that point. And he said, well, if you read the press release that Kepler put out, that NASA put out for this one, they don't say it's Earth's twin. They're more talking about the fact this is the first Goldilocks zone planet, and that's cool. And it is reasonably Earth-like in radius, but they don't make any claims. The media's jumped to that claim, and that's probably because everyone's very interested and excited by exoplanets at the moment. It's not Kepler's fault, but it's frustrating to constantly see everyone talk about Earth's twin. I think this is the third Earth's twin I've seen in a good year and a half.
One astronomer told me that discovery of such importance should be examined through scientific press and not by press releases. Have you any thoughts about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult not to get excited about things. And, there are regions of physics that are very, very interesting to everyone for whatever reason that may be. It's just cultural, historical. But certainly the search for an Earth twin is something that people seem to really want. And that's understandable. I don't, if these things were just left in the literature, as hundreds of exoplanets are, there are hundreds of exoplanets. We don't announce every single one to much fanfare. I don't know. Should NASA have not put out that press release? I don't know. That seems perhaps too... that would have been very restrained. Should the media perhaps have been slightly more careful in the write-ups? Yes. Perhaps they couldn't have necessarily called it Earth's twin. But they did. So we're kind of there now, I guess. But I don't know. I'm conflicted on that one. I probably am not going to be very rational in my response there. I think it's a shame that people can't report it in perspective. But then why report it if you're not going to call it Earth's twin? Because apparently no one will care. So,
to wrap up, do you think we will find an Earth's twin? You know, what sort of timescales are we looking at?
We are, as I say, now at the point where we have been looking at these planets, these stars, sorry, long enough with Kepler that we're going to start finding the ones that take years to go around their star. And that means we're entering into the territory of Earth-like planets, because by definition, we can certainly find small planets, and they certainly find lots of them. I would guess that in the next year, 2 years, we're going to see an awful lot of things like this, Earth-like planets. So I would guess it is only a matter of time. It's a statistics game, really, till we find something that is very Earth-like. Exactly when, I don't know. I really wouldn't. It could be in the next year. I mean, it really could, which is awesome. And, you know, when that story gets reported, I hope we haven't said too many times about having found Earth's twin, because it is very exciting. It's also, just to add in one more thing here, what's also brilliant and amazing about Kepler is every single planet it finds is slightly different. You know, never forget what it's like in terms of the Earth. These things are all interesting in their own right. And that's really amazing. So the fact that Kepler's popping out hundreds of these things over time and is confirming them over a longer time, of course, this is amazing in itself. And that really ought to be the story, that we're finding this plethora of worlds out there, this Pandora's box of planets that are coming in all these shapes and sizes. The galaxy, it would seem, is absolutely teeming with planets, billions of them probably. And a good chunk of them are going to be Earth-like, and sooner or later we will be able to say how many we think are just like the Earth, and that is interesting. But there's all these worlds out there that all tell us something different, and all, you know, we think all our planets are interesting in the solar system. Well, they get even more interesting. So that I think is an optimistic way to look at this story, just the amazing variety of worlds that are out there. Some of them like ours, but some of them are really weird and interesting in other ways.
Okay, thank you, Rob Simpson.
No problem. Thank you.
Now, there were plans this week announced by David Cameron to give anonymised NHS patient data to private companies for use in medical research. But should they do this? David Eastman has been exploring the issue.
Let's say I was to fly from London to Latvia, travel to a small town, wait until early evening when it was quite busy in the main square, take all my clothes off in one corner of the main square, run across from one corner to the other shouting, yippee, 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 run all the way back, then put my clothes back on, travel back to the airport and fly back to London. Now, I've been about as public as I possibly can be, and so you would imagine everybody would recognise me, yes? Well, no, they wouldn't, because in Latvia no one knows who I am. So I've just demonstrated the difference between privacy and anonymity, which are completely different things. If I was famous, of course, I wouldn't have any of this wonderful anonymity in the first place, so this wouldn't actually work. Now, moving away swiftly from this awkward analogy, you might think I'm just going to go straight to the NHS story that David Cameron has invited drug companies to use NHS data, but I'm not, because there are really two sides to this story, and I've only just started talking about the first side of it. Headlines such as plans to share confidential NHS records with private medical researchers sort of sounds quite dramatic, and it's not untrue, but the real story, which is plans to turn NHS records into a set of data points that may be retrieved by a query, doesn't really sound quite so interesting. Medical researchers, of course, aren't interested in personal contact details. They just want to know, out of 1,000 cases, what was the response to a certain drug. They don't want to know, ha-ha, Jane Doe, she got the clap once. That just isn't going to be of any use when developing a new drug. You are, of course, just a statistic, and reduced to a set of data points, you're literally just a statistic. So it's nice to know that merely by going to hospital and coming out again, you're doing something for medical research. Hey, that's good. And I'd love to leave it there. Get the public to pull themselves together and forge on into a brave new world. Unfortunately, I can't. Having recently just gone to hospital and done various outpatient clinic visits, I know how bad the NHS are with private data. Because however wonderful anonymised data might be, I'm not sure I entirely trust the NHS to produce that anonymised data in the first place. Are they going to outsource the job? Or are they going to ask private companies just to query the columns that they should be doing? Either way, there's plenty of possibility for hanky-panky, whether accidental or on purpose. So on the one hand, I think science-minded folk have the responsibility to back the plan in general, given the effect it will have on medical research, and accepting that anonymised data isn't the same as private data. But on the other hand, I think one has to wonder if the NHS in particular are the right people to prepare the data. This suggests some trusted third party to take the private data, prepare appropriate anonymised data, and then give access to any medical research company, or in fact anybody, that required it. The question of who owns this sort of data is much less interesting than the question who can best and most responsibly use this sort of data. In short, it's just a question of trust. This has been David Eastman for the Pod Delusion. Oh, and sorry, Jane, about the clap thing. Thanks.
Now, fashion. Perhaps not what you'd expect from the Pod Delusion, but in this next report, our catwalk correspondent, Stephen Sumpter, has been donning his beret and his scarf despite being indoors, and he's here to preview H&M's winter collection. Now, obviously, with this being a fashion piece, we'll have to apologise in advance as audio really just doesn't cut it. Even though you'll understand the point he's trying to make, you won't be able to implicitly feel bad about not being suitable for casting in a live-action remake of Funny Bones. Oh well, here's Stephen with more.
There seems to be a big fuss going on about H&M confessing to using virtual models on their website. The people at Jezebel.com realised that H&M display clothes on models that are put together by a computer, and they mentioned this fact on Monday. Since then, the story has been picked up all over the place, culminating in stories in The Telegraph and The Daily Mail and a phone-in on Radio 5. The story has provoked an angry response from a lot of people, and many have pointed out problems. I agree with most of their points. Displaying clothes in this way can contribute towards defining a particular body image as the norm, and it can create an unrealistic ideal in the minds of women and in what people expect of their partners. There is no range of body shapes and sizes shown, which can't help people who are unhappy with their own shape and size. I could see this contributing to eating disorders and mental health problems too. I think, though, that this is being sensationalised by the media and blown out of proportion. Accusations that this is being done to keep costs down or to get perfect models or with some malicious intention are wrong. One comment I saw said, "Even the bodies of professional models are too imperfect to properly advertise clothing with, even with Photoshop. The only solution was to invent an entirely virtual body that no human being actually has." I can see why people would get to this conclusion, but it just isn't true. Here is what is really happening. H&M use a virtual dressing room created by a company called Looklet. The clothes are photographed on a mannequin, and the human models are photographed separately. The whole lot is processed and put on a website. Then the computer can take whichever clothes are desired and put them on a model to create an outfit to the customer's own specification. The point is to allow customers to see what their chosen outfit looks like, which encourages them to buy that item of clothing and maybe to buy other clothes and accessories that they have tried on the virtual model. On the H&M website, there is a mix of photographs showing clothes on real models and clothes on virtual models. It is possible to tell which pictures used a virtual model, since all of the models for the virtual dressing room are shown with the same pose, left hand on hip. For most items, there is a link below the photo, which will take the customer to the virtual dressing room to customise their outfit. As I said, this whole situation is being sensationalised by the press. H&M never said that they didn't use computer models, and they haven't confessed to anything at all, just acknowledged the truth when people noticed. I'm sure that many people had noticed what was going on earlier occasions when they used the website to mix and match clothes. H&M aren't the only ones to do this either. Other clothing brands like the Swedish JC use Looklet. Strangely, so do Absolut Vodka. There are steps that could be taken to make this better, not all of them practical. The clothes could be photographed in a range of different sizes, but a single new size would double the work required to process the images and get them onto the website, and in practice it is not affordable. It could be made clearer that the virtual models are not real people, with a notice to that effect on the website, and perhaps H&M shouldn't use the virtual models mixed in with their real ones. The virtual models could be made less human, although making them look like a Barbie doll might be a bit too condescending. In the end, I don't believe that this is anything like the scandal that people think it is. People have looked at the headlines with words like confess in them and made assumptions, but few have gone to the website and experimented with creating looks to see what the real reason for having virtual models is. The ability to create looks is useful, and is enjoyed by many people as a creative outlet as well as being a marketing tool. Yes, it has its drawbacks, but perhaps they are worth working around to get the useful features too. This is Stephen Sumter for the Pod Delusion.
Now, we've covered a couple of space launches on the Pod Delusion over the last few weeks, but what you often forget is that while we're busy blasting off new stuff, the grandads of them all, Voyager 1 and 2, are still out there, pipe in hand, watching Cash in the Attic, and making remarks that would be deemed slightly racist by today's standards. So it raises the question, what are they doing these days? Liz Luckendorf has been finding out.
We've had quite a few reports lately about spacey things, many conducted by either Cash, Farouk, or myself, but today I was able to have a quick chat with Dr. Ed Stone, former director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the project scientist for the Voyager project since 1972. Voyager 1 and 2 are now about to pass out of our solar system, which is an amazing feat in itself, as it's billions of kilometers away from the Earth. But next year, they're also going to be 35 years old. Amazed by the longevity and the science of the project, we approached the fine folks at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory for an interview. So where are Voyager 1 and 2 right now? Here's Ed Stone explaining just that.
The two Voyagers are both headed out of the solar system, but they're headed in somewhat different directions. Voyager 1 is headed north above the plane of the ecliptic of the planets, and Voyager 2 is headed south. And we have found that the regions they're in are distinctly different now. They're both in what's in the region beyond the supersonic wind, where the wind is beginning to turn to go down the tail of the bubble the sun creates around itself called the heliosphere.
Do they both have identical instruments on them, or were they tailored differently to observe different things?
The two spacecraft were intended and are, in fact, are identical as far as we could make them. There's one difference, though, in the instruments which are currently on, and that is that on Voyager 2, we have five working instruments. We measure the magnetic field of the sun that's carried out there. It's very, very weak. We measure the wind, 1.5 million kilometer per hour wind that blows radii out through the sun and is now slowed down. We measure the what are called energetic ions, and we measure cosmic rays, which are coming in from outside of the solar bubble. And finally, we measure the waves in the wind itself. We have exactly the same instruments on Voyager 1, except that the instrument measuring the speed of the wind has not worked since 1980.
Have they both, you know, made independent discoveries, or do the things they do confirm with each other, if you know what I mean?
Well, the two spacecraft are both doing independent things because they're in different places. And, for instance, we discovered, the solar wind that comes outward from the sun at 400 kilometers per second is supersonic. But as it begins to approach contact with the interstellar wind outside, it has to go through a sonic shock. Voyager 1 found that shock at a distance of 94 astronomical units, where the Earth is one astronomical unit from the sun. Voyager 2 in the south found it at basically 84 astronomical units. So there's something outside in interstellar space that's pushing harder in the south than in the north, and we think that's the interstellar magnetic field. So that's an example where they each made a discovery, but in fact, taken together, it added another discovery.
how is the mission profile changed as our understanding of the universe and, you know, the solar system and physics in general changed? Was there any scope built in the missions to deal with that sort of change?
When we built the Voyager spacecraft in the early 1970s, and they were launched in 1977, this was a mission of exploration and discovery. And so we built instruments to the extent we could at that time that were broadband, that would sort of try to sense whatever was there, because we knew that we would be discovering things that we didn't even realize were there to be discovered. So in that sense, we built a very broadly exploratory spacecraft. Since they're computer-controlled, we can, in fact, change their way they operate by changing by sending up new instructions for the onboard computers. And we have done that, and we continue to do that every 6 months. If there's something special we want to do, we send up a set of instructions to the computers, and then the spacecraft will do that very special set of observations. But there's also a baseline set of observations that it makes day after day, year after year, and returns them to Earth continuously.
I imagine to finish the Grand Tour, there was longevity built into it, but were they really expected to last this long?
It's interesting that that when these two spacecraft were launched in 1977, the space age itself was only 20 years old, so we could not have known, but we were optimistic, and we knew the power source would last this long because it's natural radioactive decay of plutonium-238. It's a source of heat. As it decays, and your thermocouples convert that into electricity, and it's a predictable decrease. Every year we have 4 watts less energy than we had the year before, because that's the radioactive decay. It's 88-year half-life. So we knew that we had the power, and the power would keep the two space running with all the instruments on until 2020, and then we'll have to start shutting off instruments one at a time as we continue to lose 4 watts every year, until about 2025, when we would have to turn off the spacecraft.
And I guess with the changing nature of science and what we want to discover about the solar system, and you've mentioned that you can program it differently, are there new mission elements added, or was everything planned out and you're sticking to that plan?
Well, first of all, when we launched, the mission had been planned in detail only through Saturn. And mission success would have been one of the two spacecraft successfully flying by Saturn, its moon Titan, and the rings. Voyager 1 did that. That allowed us to leave Voyager 2 in the plane of the planets to go on to Uranus, so that was 1980 when we just made that decision. Got to Uranus in 1986. That worked. So we then added another mission leg to go on to Neptune, which was 1989. And since 1990, we've been in the interstellar mission, and we do make changes. So for instance, we now rotate the spacecraft occasionally so that our instruments can look in other directions to find the wind. Because in their normal orientation, we don't see the wind from all directions, only the wind in a plane.
We've reported on the perhaps no longer able to continue Phobos Grunt mission that was launched recently. It made us think, has there ever been any very close calls or points in time where you've lost contact with any of with either of the probes?
We lost ability to command, which, of course, is a very important capability. You have to be able to tell the spacecraft what to do occasionally. And we lost that in shortly after launch in 1978 on Voyager 2, and had to go to the backup receiver. One reason we have a long-lived spacecraft is we have redundant systems. We have duplicates of the key system. So we had a backup command receiver. We switched to that. The backup system had a fault, so we went back to the primary system, which then no longer worked. So they went to the secondary system. We've been flying now a mission all on just one command receiver, which has a defect in it, but which we've managed to work around for the last 31 years quite successfully. That was probably the most riskiest time we had, in the sense that if we weren't able to command the spacecraft, we would not have been able to complete even the first leg of the mission to Jupiter and Saturn.
The newest press release from NASA was that Voyager has entered into something called the magnetic doldrums. Could you explain what that means, and was this expected?
No, it wasn't. As I said, there's a wind blowing radially outward from the sun in all directions. It creates this huge bubble around the sun called the heliosphere. And as the solar wind, first it has to go through a sonic shock, and then it starts to turn because it can't go beyond a certain distance. It runs into the interstellar wind. So it actually has to turn slowly but surely from the radial outward flow to flowing northward, which takes it back toward the tail of the heliosphere. The heliosphere is a comet-shaped object because there's an interstellar wind that creates a long tail behind it. Well, we expected we would see the wind in the heliosheath, which is where we are, where it's a subsonic wind, we would start seeing it turn northward. And what we started seeing was indeed this radial outward flow was going down, and then when we looked to see if it was flowing northward, it wasn't flowing northward either. It was just the wind was just slowing down into sort of like a doldrums or stagnation region, where the wind is sort of erratic in its direction and very low speed. That tells us we're very close to crossing the boundary of the heliosphere and entering interstellar space.
There's been so much science and so many images and just data sent back from, you know, the farthest reaches of our solar system. How much understanding have these probes given us for, or confirmation of our best models for where we live in the universe, essentially?
Well, the Voyager really has completely changed our view of the solar system. For instance, before Voyager, the only known active volcanoes in the solar system were here on Earth. No other place had active volcanoes. We got to Jupiter. It has a moon, Io, which is a small moon, like our moon, and it has 8 active volcanoes. It has 10 times the volcanic activity of the whole Earth. And so suddenly, going from the situation where we thought only the Earth had active volcanoes to where a little moon of Jupiter had 10 times more volcanic activity, completely changed our perception of the distinctive bodies that are out there in the solar system and the kind of dynamic processes which have shaped them and which continue to shape them today.
Thank you so much for this interview. That was wonderful.
That's great. Thank you.
As usual, you can find the longer version of this interview at the Pod Delusion website. You can also find out what Voyager 1 and 2 are up to by heading over to NASA and the JPL's website. I'm still amazed, even after 2 years and 50 interviews for this program, that lovely people like Ed Stone are happy to talk to us about amazing endeavors of science and technology. This is Liz Lussendorf, in a state of awe, for the Pod Delusion.
Now in this next report, Adam Jacobs has been thinking about the actions of an unscrupulous bank. I know, I'm struggling to imagine such a thing too. But what it does raise is some interesting questions about corporate responsibility. Here's Adam Jacobs taking responsibility for this next report.
Earlier this week, the Financial Services Authority completed an investigation into some goings-on at HSBC Bank. HSBC had been selling unsuitable investment products to elderly people in care homes. The products in question, known as asset-backed investment products, were designed for long-term investment, typically with a minimum period of 5 years. Many of those who were sold these products were not expected to live as long as 5 years, and so HSB's behaviour in selling the products was clearly inappropriate. Now, I'm sure it must come as a shock to hear that a bank was taking advantage of vulnerable elderly people. You probably thought that banks were lovely institutions who care about nothing else more than helping vulnerable people. Yep, a bit of a shocker this one, isn't it? But anyway, don't worry, because the FSA was on the case. HSBC were fined £10.5 million for this episode, which apparently is the largest ever retail fine they have ever imposed. So that's all right then. Justice has been done. Well, not really. £10.5 million may sound like a lot of money, but it's peanuts to an organisation like HSBC. HSBC made a profit of nearly £2 billion, that's billion with a B, as in B for bastard, in the first half of this year alone. In other words, they were fined about 2 days' profits, hardly something that threatens their existence. But actually, I think the trivial sum of money involved is not really the issue here. The problem is that the fine was imposed on the company. Let's think about what that means. That means that it's the shareholders of HSBC who have to pay for this. In other words, that's pretty much anyone who has a pension fund. I'd be surprised if at least a part of my pension fund wasn't invested in HSBC shares. Yours probably is too. Now, I feel a bit miffed about this because I've been fined because of the scumbaggery of people at HSBC, and I don't think it was really my fault. You might argue that, as a shareholder, I should take more interest in the way the company is run, turn up and vote at shareholder meetings, get rid of any directors I think are a bit dodgy, and so on. But I don't actually own any HSBC shares directly. Having part of my pension fund invested in them doesn't give me any voting rights. Same for the millions of others who have pension funds. Even if I had invested directly in the shares myself, I'm not sure it's completely realistic for a shareholder to be able to have that level of knowledge and control over what's going on in the company. No, the people who really should be expected to know what's going on and prevent scumbaggery from happening are the board of directors. If the directors of HSBC had been personally fined £10.5 million, that would have sent a message. And what's more, if the authorities were in the habit of fining directors personally when stuff like this happened, I'm guessing that directors would take a bit more care to make sure robust procedures were in place to stop things like this happening in the first place. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know whether the FSA would have had powers to fine the directors personally. Certainly the Companies Act 2006 places various duties on directors, such as a duty to exercise reasonable care, skill and diligence. It's pretty clear that the directors breached that duty in a common sense sort of way, although I can't be sure that they did in a legal way. But something is terribly wrong here when the people who get punished are shareholders who did nothing wrong, and the people who were responsible for the scumbaggery get away scot-free. If the FSA don't have the powers to fine directors personally, then Parliament needs to give them those powers, and if they do, then they should use them. And this case isn't an isolated incident. Just a few weeks ago, the energy company Npower were fined £2 million by Ofgem for mishandling complaints. Again, it was the company that was fined. The directors of the company didn't face any consequences personally. Ah, I hear you cry. It's easy for you to say all this. Being a company director is a difficult job, and you'd feel differently if you were a company director. Well, as it happens, I am a company director, albeit of a much smaller company than HSBC. I have no problem with being held accountable for my actions. I take my responsibilities as a director seriously and make sure that my company does not do scumbaggish things. If I did, I think it would be quite right if I were to feel the force of the law. And let's face it, directors of companies like HSBC get stratospheric pay packages. Isn't it right that that kind of reward requires some sort of responsibility in return? There's a growing sense that something is not right in society, that a few elite people at the top have a huge amount of power and money, while the 99%, in the words of the Occupy movement, are largely being shafted. To me, hearing this story of how corporate misbehaviour has been handled does nothing but reinforce that impression. This has been Adam Jacobs for The Pod Delusion.
Now, everyone knows that exams are getting easier these days. Back in my day, we didn't have any of this multiple choice nonsense. We had to write essays for our answers entirely in Latin, even our English exams. And even though this opinion can't be proven, it's nothing to do with subconscious jealousy towards the kids of today, with their whole lives ahead of them, growing up in an era of unparalleled access to knowledge and learning, using technology that we could only have dreamed of, and yet to make the mistakes that we have. No! They're making exams easier, dammit! As Peter Rowlett may or may not be claiming in this next report.
Many people complain about declining standards of education. I work in mathematics higher education in England and Wales, and people are often complaining about the decreased preparedness of students coming from A-level, both for those taking maths degrees and those taking degrees from other subjects which need maths. Here is an example. It is a subject of wonder and regret to many that this Ireland, having astonished Europe by the most glorious display of talents in mathematics and the sciences dependent upon them, should suddenly suffer its ardour to cool, and almost entirely to neglect those studies in which it infinitely excelled all other nations. Okay, you can tell by the language that that isn't a 21st century writer. So when do you think it was? Have a guess? The quote was from a letter by John Topless from my hometown of Nottingham on 13th of October 1804, entitled On the Decline of Mathematical Studies and the Sciences Dependent Upon Them.
For a mid-20th century example, I have the blurb from a 1960 printing of a 1941 book, What is Mathematics?, by Richard Corrent and Herbert Robbins in the US. This speaks about the importance of mathematics in modern society and includes the following. Unfortunately, these aspects of mathematics have been greatly neglected in the recent past. Most of us have been subjected to a routine mathematical training in high school. Few of us have any real understanding of mathematics and what it is all about. So, has mathematics in schools really been declining for hundreds of years? Is this a continual decline or a cyclical one? Or is it just that every generation thinks the next one is suffering declining standards? In which case, what does that say about current concerns? In the 1990s, a phenomenon was identified called the mathematics problem. A 2000 report, Measuring the Mathematics Problem, collected evidence of what it calls a serious decline in students' mastery of basic mathematical skills and level of preparation for mathematics-based degree courses, and the resultant acute problems now confronting those teaching mathematics and mathematics-based modules at university. As someone who runs maths education workshops for lecturers, I am acutely aware that many put many of the issues they encounter down to the preparedness of incoming students from A-level. Recently, I read an interesting report by Michael Grove. For full disclosure reasons, I should point out that Michael directs the National HE STEM program, which provides funding for my project. Michael points out that one of the key findings of Measuring the Mathematics Problem was that there was an insufficient number of A-level candidates with satisfactory grades in mathematics. Well, in recent years, these numbers have been taking off, with mathematics now one of the most popular A-level subjects. So, Michael asks, is the problem complained about today the same as that documented 15 years ago? Michael points to a recent Institute of Physics report, Mind the Gap, which found that many physics and engineering lecturers feel new undergraduates within their disciplines are underprepared as they commence their university studies due to a lack of fluency in mathematics. This, as Michael points out, is despite the evidence that they are typically arriving at university with increased mathematics grades. The problem may be what Michael points out as a key finding of the Institute of Physics report, that many of the academics surveyed believe that current mathematics and physics provision at A-level leads to students learning by rote rather than through their own independent techniques. A 2008 report entitled Newton's Mechanics, Who Needs It? Highlighted similar concerns. Whether this is correct or not is a difficult question. In order that this segment doesn't seem wholly negative about mathematics A-level, I should point out that a lot of this is relative, and there are many brilliant mathematicians coming out of A-level courses. A lot of what I take from these reports is advice on how we should be designing mathematics courses at university to complement what has been learned in school, rather than saying anything about individual achievement or the value of an A-level qualification. Mathematics itself is an interesting discipline whose graduates have excellent prospects, and those subjects which need maths have increased recently, with increasing use of mathematical modelling and the need to analyse large data sets in chemistry and the biological, health and social sciences. A recent report, Mathematical Needs, from the Advisory Committee on Mathematics Education, warned that many disciplines don't feel they can ask incoming students for an A-level in mathematics, even though it is really needed in their discipline. Given its importance across a range of subjects, A-level mathematics is among the best A-levels you can do. As someone who graduated A-level mathematics right at the bottom of the decline in the 1990s, as, by the way, did many current university mathematics lecturers, I have still managed to lead a fairly competent mathematical life. So whether Michael's analysis is correct or not, it is interesting to think that although the complaints are the same 10 years on, the underlying cause might be shifting. It is important to keep on top of this shift, or your attempts to address the complaints will become increasingly irrelevant. Michael finishes by talking about some current work taking place in the areas he feels need addressing. If you're interested in that sort of thing, you can find some links to further reading on the Pod Delusion website. This is Peter Rowlett, Declining in Standard, for the Pod Delusion.
Now in this next report, Kylie Sergis has been speaking to someone who's written an intriguing book, a book about tribal science. So I assume Kylie is going to sit in the bushes and describe the interviewee from afar, so not to intrude on his traditional way of life.
I'm Carly Sturgis, reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Science is a tribal endeavour. It's a social behaviour humans engage in, one that is based upon shared values of logic, reason, empiricism, and the right to debate the merits of belief. What are the ideals of the science methodology, and what is the reality of how people use, or don't use, their brains? Michael McRae is an Australian science writer working for the CSIRO's Education Department. He has a science degree. He has worked as a medical science in a Queensland pathology laboratory. With a Bachelor of Education in Science and Mathematics, he's taught in Brisbane and then in London. He also earned a Diploma of Science Communication via the joint ANU Questacon Science Circus program. He's currently reading for his Masters in Culture, Health and Medicine at ANU in Canberra. This interview was looking at his new book called Tribal Science, Brains, Beliefs and Bad Ideas. Michael, you start this book by talking about a fascination that you've always had for collective behaviour, not just in animals but in people. Not everyone writes a book about it, however. Tell us more about how this book came to be.
It actually ultimately started a couple of years back when I gave a talk for Bris Science that was titled A Wolf in Sheep's Lab Coat. And I'd already done a bit of research and reading into it. In fact, for years I've been interested in the concept of science philosophy and how pseudoscience works. And I think it was in that process just seeing how the concept of pseudoscience kind of emerged from how people operate as a social species. And that got me more and more fascinated about the whole idea, I guess, behind science as a social practice. We're really quite good at looking at humans in a sociological sense. We're wonderful looking at animals in the same sort of way. But one thing we don't tend to do very well is look at science as a human behavior, or not just a human behavior, but as an animal behavior. That was where I really became quite fascinated in how it all worked together as a sociological concept.
You mentioned that teaching science in the future will require skills and values that work with the social brain, not in spite of them. What within your research led you to this conclusion?
Mostly something called social epistemology. People aren't very good at learning in isolation. So we're not, in spite of how past an education seems to work, where you've got a teacher that almost communicates in a one way to individual students who all just happen to be collected together in this great big class. But we're not very good at learning that way. We tend to learn more by looking at how other people operate, watching how they are rewarded or punished depending on how they succeed and fail at understanding certain things or how they behave. So there's this collective behavior where we look at other people and base our own actions on what happens to them and how they work. Understanding that and understanding how people work in a social context and learning, especially in a classroom environment, is vital for the students to be able to pick up information in the easiest way, and better still, learning how to critically evaluate information that comes their way.
It could be difficult, though. I mean, this observation, if you're seeing what happens in the classroom is one thing, while what happens in the wider world is completely another, particularly if you bring in things like the fame factor or being endorsed by popular culture, how well can educators challenge this?
I don't think it is that different, to be honest. I think the structure that tends to occur within schools is very much an authority-based for classroom management. It's often easier to deal with limited resources and to deal with certain structures, to get kids from diverse backgrounds or diverse understandings, and to try to work with them in a limited context. And that's where the problems tend to occur primarily in the classroom, and that's where you get a difference between the classroom and the outside world. But that said, the same social epistemology, that same level of understanding about things and how people learn, doesn't really change between the classroom social environment and the external environment. To facilitate it better, however, one will take teachers having those diverse skills to be able to actually recognize how students can learn collectively. So, you know, simple things that teachers have known for decades, like peer learning, you know, getting kids to basically work together and teaching one another how to do things. But I think also mediating the restrictions that exist in the classroom in terms of resources and in terms of things like evaluation. In the past, evaluation has very much been focused on something that can be marked very simply and can give quite a clear quantitative response. So you get it, say, a number. What doesn't seem to occur so much is qualitative assessment. So being able to actually give a contextual understanding of how a student might understand something that allows you to work the resources better for them. So in other words, you know, you're looking at the student in their actual context, what they know from previously, their prior knowledge, mm-hmm. and applying that and helping them to work better with their peers so they can catch up and understand certain things. And that's quite tricky to do with limited resources.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you need to be able to differentiate your work, for instance. So you can't come in just with a one-size-fits-all lesson, plug it in and say, all right, everyone's going to learn this way. You do need to be able to recognize that students are going to have subtly different ways of working the same resource and kind of modify it. A classic example of that, I guess, was in the UK when I taught a group of year sevens. Now, these year sevens were from diverse backgrounds, though there were some that were relatively illiterate. They couldn't read or write.
Yeah.
There are others whose English was quite limited, and they're all thrown in this class. That's often, again, the challenge that educators often face is, you know, you're being given a class, and sometimes the best you can expect from that class is for them to show up and for them to actually cooperate in a social environment. So, you know, they're still learning something just by being there in the first place, and anything else is a bonus. Start there and explain certain things and have them gain an understanding that they can engage and ask questions on. The downside of that, obviously, is when it comes to an exam, you know, you're one size fits all, here's a piece of paper, read the question, answer it. They struggled. And so these kids were giving back marks that just did not reflect their understanding of science whatsoever. So I had to actually petition to try to evaluate them in a slightly different way so I could reflect their understanding of science better. That wasn't simply a consequence of their low literacy.
How do we persuade a wider audience to look at evidence?
I think one thing is trying to understand that what the word evidence means. It's so easily assumed that evidence is, you know, when we talk evidence, we talk about science, we talk about scientific evidence.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's a bit of a circular reasoning with that, because if you're talking about scientific evidence, you then say, okay, well, what's science? And then you get into, well, science is about using evidence. Well, what's evidence? Well, evidence has something to do with science. And, you know, we rarely step outside of that and say, really, what does the word evidence mean? Not just to people like us who hold science in high regard, but to people who don't. Because when you go up to them and say you're not using evidence, obviously they're going to shake their head and say, well, hang on a second, I am using evidence, and you're cross-talking. Most people simply take the term evidence to mean anything that increases or decreases your confidence in an understanding or a belief. Regardless of whether it's produced using values of logic, reason, using quantitative methodologies, those sort of things. So once you've got a bit of an understanding that people evaluate their evidence in subtly different ways, people use different values and will come to critically understand the information they've got using those different values, then you've got something you can start with. You can start to understand their perspective and then almost lead them in a way to either challenging those values into thinking what ways might be producing productive knowledge in the long run. But I mean, that's where you have to start. Alternatively, a lot of people seem to start with just the assumption of evidence, and they come up and say, well, hang on, here's these beliefs, this is what you must understand. And you get cultural conflict there. You've got basically someone who doesn't share your cultural background struggling to try to understand why it is that what you're saying is important, and often failing, just as a lot of scientists will fail to understand where other people who don't hold those values might be coming from. So the challenge is basically trying to promote those values and make them appealing and make them actually see that they are robust, that they're useful. And I think that's where we have to go in the future, is trying to actually promote that level of understanding, that level of sympathy between people in diverse groups and people who come from a scientific background.
Michael McRae's book, Tribal Science, Brains, Beliefs and Bad Ideas, is now available through Prometheus Press. You can see his website at www.tribalscientist.wordpress.com. This is Kylie Sturgis for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, in the run-up to Christmas, it's easy to see who's getting everyone's attention. That's right, it's that perennial attention hog, Jesus Christ. People are always claiming he's done something new and amazing, though as far as I can tell, he's just coasting off some past successes. You know, a bit like Ricky Gervais. So enough is enough. In this next report, Drew Ray recognises some real heroes.
A common theme in studies of religion is the way man created God in his own image. Whilst we are told that gods are just, merciful, and all-powerful, these are what are often called informed abilities. They don't match what we actually see. Just like how we might be told that a TV character is a super genius, but we never actually see them solve a difficult problem, we're told that our gods are good, but see them behave in ways that are petty, jealous, angry. All the ways we'd expect humans to behave. Rich, conservative people invent gods who love capitalism and hate gay marriage. Poor, oppressed people worship gods who offer salvation in a future life. When humans worship such gods, we elevate the worst of ourselves and ignore the best that humanity has to offer. I thought it was time to prepare an article about worshipping things worth worshipping. I'm talking about those qualities that we make into songs of praise. Goodness, sacrifice, mercy, and greatness. Let's start with guardian angels. The best description of guardian angels I've heard comes from the 1996 movie The Preacher's Wife. God's got these angels waiting in a long line to come down and help. I've met guardian angels. They work for an organisation that in Australia is called Lifeline. I think the UK equivalent is called the Samaritans. Any time of night or day, in a small room with a couple of cubicles, there's someone sitting with a cup of tea, a magazine, and a headset. If you have a moment of crisis, you call, and they will answer. You can call at 2 p.m. on a Wednesday afternoon. You can call at 3 a.m. on Christmas Day. And still, there's going to be someone sitting there, just waiting for you. When I hear hymns or songs about the great sacrifice God has supposedly made for us, I think of the real sacrifices that people make for each other. There are too many great examples to list them all, but here are a few. Firstly, people who care for elderly or disabled people. There are plenty of folk who need full-time, laborious, in-home care, and sometimes even lack the ability to express gratitude. Those who care for them sacrifice income, alternate careers, and often even the opportunity to socialise. That is loving sacrifice, worthy of hymns of praise. There are people who work out of the spotlight so that others can achieve great things. I know of firms where it's historically impossible to make partnership level without a spouse or partner not in paid employment. That is sacrifice. Equally, there are those who give up the chance at elected office to run an electoral office instead, or who take the blame for others' mistakes to prevent their opponents bringing them down. And thirdly, battlefield medics. It seems almost silly to single out a part of an entire military filled with those who risk and serve for others. But I'm personally in awe of the medics. Military casualties are almost by definition in places no sane soldier wants to be, and the medics head straight for those spots time after time. The high risk of physical harm and the guaranteed psychological wounds outweigh anything any god has ever done for me. And how about mercy? That's a simple one. Families and victims of violent crime are statistically less likely to support the death penalty. Is there a deity in any pantheon who can match that level of mercy? And finally, greatness. My politics are somewhat left of centre, so I'm not accustomed to praising market forces. However, I have to admit that I had a bowl of porridge this morning. Porridge in a bowl with a metal spoon, with milk and jam. Is there a single recorded instance of a god doing anything as fantastically great as creating the civilization that brought me that bowl of porridge? The complexity of the mining, production, farming, manufacturing, and distribution process to bring those ingredients together time after time for all of us is phenomenal. But it not only works, it works consistently. When tomorrow I change my mind and I want a different flavouring or even a different cereal, The system won't break or fall apart. Think on that for a minute. That is true greatness. Humans are very strange people. I find them quite hard to understand most of the time, as individuals and en masse. But humans are pretty amazing people too. This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Now, before we go, do remember what I said at the start of the show. Our deputy editor, Liz, is looking for a job. So if you can help her out, if you've got any leads, if you need someone to do something cool in London, then head over to our website and find her CV. Also on our website, you can find links to donate and help support the Pod Delusion. Also on our website, you can find links to donate and support the Pod Delusion. You can make one-off donations or donate £5 or £10 a month. It will all really be appreciated, especially at this challenging time. Of course, also on our website, you can listen back to older episodes of The Pod Delusion, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook, and all that sort of thing. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, David Eastman, Stephen Sumter, Liz Lutgendorf, Peter Rowlett, Kylie Sturgis, Drew Ray, and me, James O'Malley. The sketch was by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The song In a Moment is by Ben Jones. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
The Global Village. Tonight, a report on the recent UK riots shows a surprising new theory. To discuss it, I'm joined by... Well, what is your name?
I want to stay anonymous, you know. Unrecognisable, like a member of One Direction, you get me?
Indeed. Well, thank you for coming in.
That's okay. I think it's important that the people know what's been going on. For years now, the youth of today in this country have been manipulated to keep us in our place, you know?
You're talking about the police?
No, bruv. There's greater forces at work. Ask yourself the question, bruv. When the kids get something wrong on the street, how does they get caught?
Well, the police catch him in the act and arrest him.
Catch him, bruv. How can some fat, flabby copper catch a fit kid? Society has dealt these kids a shit hand. That's the government, that is.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
It's the media, innit, bruv? In a peer pressure society, we follow the trends. We wear hoodies because that's what we is told to wear, innit, bruv?
And?
So we can't see the coppers coming. And even if we could, we can't run. Because our waistbands is halfway round our arses. Yeah, we took the laces out of our trainers. And we can just about go as fast as Eric Pickles in a fun run, bruv.
So you're saying the government is responsible for this?
Oh, wake up, bruv. Who runs the media? Tells kids what to wear, what's the fashion. The government, man, it's a conspiracy to catch the kids. It's been happening for years. In the 70s, it was platform shoes. You couldn't run off with a 4-inch sole and then flared trousers. They're like parachutes, bruv.
What rubbish.
You would say that, wouldn't you? Yeah, you're all in it together. Ever since them mods was fooled into riding them scooters, that was the only way that the pigs could ever catch them in a Ford Anglia.
But now you've wised up to this trick, you can take steps to make sure you're not caught in this way again.
Yeah, too right. We're modelling ourselves on a more permissive society. One that gives us more freedom that we want, you get me?
So today's fashions are...
From a Dutchman. Check out me bitching clogs, bruv.
Way back when in 1910 logicians all had read a book by Bertrand Russell and one Alfred North Whitehead. Principia Mathematica was thought the final word in formal logic reasoning, but then along came Kurt Gödel-Aiwo, 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 Gödel-Aiwo. What Godel found was quite profound. He was a clever chap. It turns out that Principia was just a pile of crap. He showed that we could never prove some statements that are true. Or if we could, our logic would be inconsistent too. System can be both consistent and complete. It's one or it's the other, and there is no way to cheat. The proof is somewhat complex, and although I think it's neat, I don't have time to sing it, 'cause this song is incomplete.